I'm very grateful to Mr. Campbell and to the Philadelphia Society for the honor of being invited to address you this afternoon. Bill, thank you for that very kind introduction. You know that email message that you sent the speakers, I think I can quote it verbatim. Look, guys, none of this fancy schmancy theoretical academic-y stuff. Keep your remarks focused on practical matters that the audience will be actually interested in. I never got it. My theme is natural law, God, and the common good. A natural law theory is a reflective critical account of the constitutive aspects of the well-being and fulfillment of human persons and the communities they form. Any such theory will propose to identify principles of right action, that is, moral principles, specifying the first and most general principle of morality, namely, that one should choose and act in ways that are compatible with a will toward integral human fulfillment. Among these principles are respect for rights people possess simply by virtue of their humanity, rights which, as a matter of justice, others are bound to respect, and governments are bound not only to respect, but to the extent possible, also to protect. Natural law theorists understand human fulfillment, the human good, as variegated. There are many irreducible dimensions of human well-being. Now, that's not to deny that human nature is determinate. It is to affirm that our nature, though determinate, is complex. We are animals, that's the kind of thing human beings are, but rational animals. Our integral good includes our bodily well-being as biological entities, but also our intellectual, moral, and spiritual well-being. We are individuals, that's the way we come, but friendship and sociability are constitutive, that is, intrinsic aspects of our flourishing. In ways that are highly relevant to moral reflection and judgment, Aristotle was absolutely right. Man is a social animal. By reflecting on the basic goods of human nature, especially those most immediately pertaining to social and political life, natural law theorists propose to arrive at a sound understanding of principles of justice, including those principles that are embodied in claims of rights, human rights. Natural law theorists reject both strict individualism and collectivism. Strict or radical individualism overlooks the intrinsic value of human sociability and tends mistakenly to view human beings atomistically. Collectivism compromises the dignity of human beings by tending to instrumentalize and subordinate their well-being to the interests of larger social units, communism, other forms of totalitarianism being the most extreme version of this. Radical individualists and collectivists both have theories of justice and human rights, but they are, at least as I see it, highly unsatisfactory. They are rooted in important misunderstandings of human nature and the human good. Neither can do justice to the concept of a human person. That is, a rational animal who is a locus of intrinsic value and is such an end in himself who may never legitimately be treated as a mere means to other ends, including larger social ends, but whose well-being intrinsically includes relationships with others and membership in communities, beginning, and above all, with a family, in which he or she, as a matter of justice, has both rights and responsibilities. I'm sometimes asked whether natural law theorists suppose that rights are hardwired into our nature. Well, I fear that this metaphor is more likely to mislead than to illuminate. Human rights exist, if it's the case, that there are principles of practical reason directing us to act or abstain from acting in certain ways out of respect for the well-being and dignity of persons whose legitimate interests may be affected by what we do, and we might here include, of course, governments at every level. Well, I certainly believe that there are such principles. As moral principles, they cannot be overridden by considerations of utility. At a very general level, they direct us, in Kant's famous phrase, to treat human beings always as ends and never as means only. When we begin to specify this general norm, we identify important duties, such as the duty to refrain from enslaving people or killing people, including unborn, partially born, or newborn human beings. Although we need not put the matter in terms of rights, it's perfectly reasonable to do so, and I believe helpful to speak in terms of, for example, a right against being enslaved or aborted, and to speak of slavery or abortion or infanticide as a violation of human rights. Human rights are rights that human beings have not by virtue of being members of any particular race or sex or class or ethnic group, but simply by virtue of our humanity. We have them irrespective of our age or size or stage of development or condition of dependency. It's what it means for the rights to be a human, a particular right to be a human right. The natural law understanding of human rights that I'm here sketching is connected with a particular account of human dignity. Under that account, the natural human capacities for reason and freedom are fundamental to the dignity of human beings, the dignity that is protected by human rights. The basic goods of human nature are goods of a rational creature, a creature who, unless impaired or prevented from doing so, naturally develops and exercises capacities for deliberation, judgment, and choice. Now, these capacities are godlike, albeit, of course, in a limited way. In fact, from the theological vantage point, they constitute a certain sharing, unique as far as we know to us in the terrestrial realm anyway, a certain sharing, limited to be sure, in divine power. This is what is meant, I believe, by the otherwise extraordinarily puzzling biblical teaching that man is made in the very image and likeness of God. But whether or not one recognizes biblical authority, or believes even believes in a personal God, it's true that human beings possess a power traditionally ascribed, not just in Western culture, but across the board, to divinity, namely, the power to be an uncaused causing. That is the power to envisage a possible state of affairs that does not exist, to grasp the point or value of bringing that state of affairs into existence, and then to act by choice and not simply on impulse or by instinct, to bring that state of affairs into existence. That state of affairs may be anything from the development of an intellectual skill or the attainment of an item of knowledge, to the creation or critical appreciation of a work of art, to the establishment of marital communion between a man and a woman. Its moral or cultural significance may be great, or far more commonly, comparatively minor. What matters for the point I'm making is that it is a product of human reason and freedom. It's the fruit of deliberation, judgment, and choice. We may, if we like, consider as a further matter whether beings capable of such powers could exist apart from a divine source and ground of their being, but I don't think it makes sense to deny that beings whose nature is to develop and exercise such powers are lacking in dignity and human rights and may therefore be treated as mere objects, instruments, property, or cogs in the wheel. Now, what about the authority for this view of human nature, the human good, human dignity, and human rights? Well, natural law theorists are interested in the intelligible reasons people have for their choices and actions. We're particularly interested in reasons that can be identified without appeal to any authority apart from the authority of reason itself. Now, that's not to deny that it's often reasonable to recognize and to submit to religious or secular, such as legal authority, in deciding what to do and not do. Indeed, natural law theorists have made important contributions to understanding why and how people often are morally bound to submit to and be guided in their actions by authority of various types, including religious authority. But even here, the special concern of natural law theorists is with the reasons people have for recognizing and honoring claims of authority. We don't simply appeal to authority to justify authority. One might then ask whether human beings are in fact rational in the way I said they were. Can we discern any intelligible reasons for human choices and actions? Do people actually act on more than merely instrumental reasons? Well, everybody recognizes that some ends or purposes pursued through human action are intelligible, at least insofar as they provide means to other ends. For example, people work to earn money, and their doing so is perfectly rational, perfectly intelligible. Money is a valuable means to many great and important ends. No one doubts its instrumental value. So even skeptics don't deny that there are instrumental goods. The question is whether there are some ends or purposes that are intelligible as providing more than merely instrumental reasons for acting. Are there intrinsic as well as instrumental goods? Are purposes or ends such as intellectual knowledge, critical appreciation or development of artistic talent or athletic prowess, virtue itself, friendship and living in harmony with each other, the formation of communities, are these intrinsic human goods? Are they constitutive aspects of human well-being and fulfillment, which as such provide more than merely instrumental reasons for action? Well, skeptics deny that there are any intelligible ends or purpose that make rationally motivated action possible. Natural law theorists, by contrast, hold that friendship, knowledge, virtue, aesthetic appreciation, and certain other ends or purposes are intrinsically valuable. They are intelligibly choice-worthy, not simply as means to other ends, but as ends in themselves. They cannot be reduced to, nor can their intelligible appeal be accounted for exclusively in terms of emotion, feeling, desire, or other subrational motivating factors. These basic human goods are constitutive aspects of the well-being and fulfillment of human persons and the communities they form, and they thereby provide the foundations of moral judgments, including our judgments pertaining to justice and human rights, our judgments regarding what constitutes the common good. Of course, there are plenty of people today who embrace philosophical or ideological doctrines that deny that the human capacities I maintain are at the core of human dignity, or they deny that there are such capacities. They believe that they're merely illusory. They adopt a purely instrumental and essentially non-cognitivist view of practical reason. The most famous articulation of this view, one that's become widely held, is David Hume's view that reason is and ought only to be the slave of the passions and can never pretend to any office other than to serve and obey them. The view that our ultimate ends or goals are given by feeling, emotion, desire, subrational factors capable of motivating people to act, and reason's only role is instrumental to find the way to the things we desire. Reason can't adjudicate between desires, say between the desires of Mother Teresa and the desires of Hitler. It can't adjudicate between them. It can only tell Mother Teresa or Hitler or any of us how to get what we happen to want, where what we want is given by desire and is immune from criticism by reason. So they argue that the experience that we all have of deliberation, judgment, and choice between more than merely instrumental options is illusory. The ends people pursue, they insist, are ultimately given by these non-rational motivating factors I mentioned, feeling, emotion, desires. In a kind of preview of what would become Hume's view, his predecessor Hobbes taught that the thoughts are to the desires as scouts and spies to range abroad and find the way to the thing desired. Truly rationally motivated action, they say, is impossible for creatures like us. There are no more than merely instrumental reasons for acting, no basic human goods. Now, if the proponents of this non-cognitivist and subjectivist view of human action are right, then it seems to me that the entire business of ethics and political theory, at least as considered as a normative discipline, is a charade and human dignity is a myth. But I don't think they are right. Indeed, I don't think that they can give any account of the norms of rationality to which they must themselves appeal in making the case against reason and freedom that is consistent with a denial that people are capable of more than merely instrumental rationality and true freedom of choice. And that's a complicated argument that I've developed elsewhere. Now, if I and other natural law theorists are correct in affirming that human reason can identify human rights as genuine grounds of obligation to others, how can we explain or understand the widespread failures to recognize and respect human rights and other moral principles? Well, as human beings, we are rational animals, but we are imperfectly rational. We are prone to making intellectual and moral mistakes and capable of behaving grossly unreasonably, especially when deflected by powerful emotions or ideologies that run contrary to the demands of reasonableness. Even when we follow our consciences, as we are, of course, bound to do, our consciences might be in error. Conscientious judgment can be flat out wrong. Some of the greatest thinkers who ever lived failed to recognize the human right to religious liberty. Their failure, I believe, was rooted in a set of intellectual errors about what such a right presupposes and entails. Now, the people who made these errors were neither fools nor knaves. The errors were not obvious, and it was only with a great deal of reflection and debate that the matter could be clarified. Of course, sometimes people fail to recognize and respect human rights and other moral principles, including at the political level, because they have self-interested motives for doing so. In most cases of exploitation, for example, the fundamental failing is moral, not intellectual. In some cases, though, intellectual and moral failures are closely connected. Selfishness, prejudice, partisanship, vanity, avarice, lust, ill will, and other moral delinquencies can, and in some ways do, in ways that are quite subtle, impede sound ethical judgments, including judgments pertaining to principles of justice, the common good, and human rights. Whole cultures or subcultures can be infected with moral failings that blind large numbers of people, even otherwise decent people, to truths about justice and human rights, and ideologies hostile to these truths will almost always be both causes and effects of these failings. Consider, for example, the case of slavery in the antebellum American South. The ideology of white supremacy was both a cause of many people's blindness to the wickedness of slavery and an effect of the exploitation and degradation of its victims. Similarly today, the ideology of lifestyle liberalism, certainly prevalent on campuses like mine, is both a cause and an effect of the inability of people in its grip to grasp the humanity of human beings in the earliest stages of development, or the profound wrong of wantonly killing them by abortion or in biomedical research. Well, let's turn to the question of God and religious faith in natural law theory. Most, but not all, natural law theorists are theists. They believe that the moral order, like every other order in human experience, is what it is because God creates and sustains it as such. In accounting for the intelligibility of the created order, they infer the existence of a free and creative intelligence, a personal God. Indeed, they typically argue that God's creative free choice provides the only ultimately satisfactory account of the existence of the intelligibilities humans grasp in every domain of inquiry, in science, in logic, in the technical domains, as well as in the moral order. Natural law theorists do not deny that God can reveal moral truths, and most of us believe that God has chosen to reveal a great many of them. However, natural law theorists also affirm that many moral truths, including some that are revealed, can also be grasped by ethical reflection apart from revelation. They assert, we assert with St. Paul, that there is a law written on the hearts, even of the Gentiles who did not know the law of Moses, a law the knowledge of which is sufficient for moral accountability. So the basic norms against murder and theft, for example, though revealed in the Decalogue, are knowable even apart from God's. An atheist's puzzlement might well cause him to reconsider the idea that there is no divine source of the order we perceive and understand in the universe. It's far less likely to cause someone to conclude that our perception is illusory or that our understanding is a sham, though that's, of course, logically possible. The question then arises, can natural law, assuming there are truly principles of natural law, provide a foundation for an account of the common good and of human rights without consensus on the existence of God? Or the nature of God and the role of God in human affairs, things people disagree about? Well, in my view, anybody who acknowledges the human capacities for reason and freedom has good grounds for affirming the profound dignity of each human being and all that follows from it, including such ideas as limited government, private property, the rule of law, the market economy, democratic accountability and governance, equality under the law, concern for public health, safety, and morals, respect for the autonomy and support for the authority of families, religious communities, and other institutions of civil society, and basic human rights. These grounds remain in place whether or not one adverts to the further question, is there a divine source of the moral order whose tenets we discern in inquiry regarding natural law and natural rights? Now, I happen to think that the answer to this question is yes, and that we should be open to the possibility that God has revealed himself in ways that reinforce and supplement what we can know by unaided reason. But as a theoretical matter, at least, we do not need agreement as to the answer so long as we agree about the truths that give rise to the question, namely that human beings possessing by nature the literally godlike, awesome powers of reason and freedom are bearers of a profound dignity that is protected by certain basic rights. The trouble is that it is difficult, as George Washington observed, and therefore rare, for people who deny the existence and sovereignty of God to avoid falling into the reductionism which causes many contemporary secularists to blind themselves to the plain facts of their own experience, and therefore to deny the qualities in virtue of which human beings, as such, possess profound, inherent, and equal dignity. Thank you.